In the U.S. as a whole, we've lost more than half of all of the reporters we had a decade ago. That's 36,000. Looking at it from a local standpoint in North Carolina, we've lost an equal number, if not more.
On this episode of the Politics Podcast, the reduction of local journalism and the rise of social media. I'm Jeff Tabiri. As always, glad to have you along. Roughly 3 million North Carolinians currently reside in what has been coined a news desert, wide swaths of our state with depleted, or in some instances, no offerings of local journalism. Yet, in this same moment, there is an abundance of digital and social media content. We certainly won't classify it all as news. While these so-called deserts have left North Carolinians parched, social media often leaves them drenched in everything from candidate videos to misinformation. On one hand, a slow drip of journalism focused on the efforts of local officials. Yet, in this same moment, exists a faucet of solicitations, conspiracy theories, and hot takes. We'll get to social media in a bit. First, news deserts. For some context, we turned to Penny Muse Abernathy, a visiting professor at Northwestern.
For me, a news desert is an area where people have difficulty getting access to critical information needs. Those are the kind of needs, information needs, that you need in order to make wise decisions when you go to the voting booth, or just to make wise decisions about what is safe for you to do today and during a COVID pandemic.
Abernathy is the author of several reports about the state of local news media. She's also the nation's leading voice on news deserts.
Well, there are two ways to look at the loss of news. One is the loss of actual newspapers, and the reason we look at newspapers is newspapers have historically been the primary means of people in North Carolina getting access to that critical local information. So if you look at it that way, the nation has lost roughly a fourth of its newspapers. And in North Carolina, we have roughly six counties without a local newspaper. And we have roughly about half of our counties with only one source of local news. Another way to look at the loss of news is the actual loss of reporters. And the loss of reporters has disproportionately hit our regional and state newspapers that have historically covered North Carolina like kudzu in many places. They were great backups for the local newspaper in that they also covered important local issues that affected more than one county. But they also roamed through the region and often stumbled across issues around corruption or transparency that had eluded the local newspaper. So in doing that, they filled huge news gaps. And in the U.S. as a whole, we've lost more than half of all of the reporters we had a decade ago. That's 36,000. Looking at it from a local standpoint in North Carolina, we've lost an equal number, if not more, of the reporters who were once on our state and regional newspapers. That puts a real hamper and on the ability of reporters that are left at these state and regional newspapers to get out of the metro area where they're located and actually help these rural, economically struggling communities come up with answers.
So you talk about reporters and news and information outlets needing to get out of these urban centers. You just answered this to an extent, but I'm going to ask it again, which is, how incumbent is it upon us, WUNC, a public radio station with decent resources and reach, upon WRAL, on some of these bigger entities to take some resources and put a reporter in, you choose, Goldsboro, New Bern, Perquimans County? Is that part of the equation to undoing some of the loss here?
I think there are two ways to look at it. One is, what can you, where can you station reporters geographically, right, that will make the most sense? Is it someone that covers four or five counties in eastern North Carolina, right, that seem to have similar problems? Another way to look at it is, what are the critical issues that aren't being covered, right? So the FCC came out with a list of eight topics that they say you and I, anybody living anywhere, need to be informed about in order to make wise decisions about the quality of our lives. That included education, it included public safety, it included environment, health, and politics and the like. So one way to think about state and regional news outlets, whether that's WRAL, whether that's the News and Observer, whether that's WUNC, is what is being done to cover those big picture topics that are going to affect the quality of life of not just people in that in a specific community, but people in a region or people in a state. And how does coverage of that relate to the ability of the state to pass policies and legislation that actually enrich the lives of people in those economically struggling communities and enrich the lives of all of us, quite frankly.
Of North Carolina's 100 counties, 58 have but a single local newspaper. Six don't have a single one. Wilson County is one of these one-paper regions. Wilson is located in the coastal plains, situated between Greenville to the east and Raleigh in the central part of the state to the west. Corey Friedman is an editor at the Wilson Times, a family-owned newspaper that celebrated its 125th year in existence just last month. Friedman has spent his entire journalism career in rural and suburban North Carolina, and that means wearing a few different hats.
Well, my main role here at the Wilson Times is as our editor. Basically, I'm in charge of all of our local news operations. I'm also heavily involved on the opinion side. I'm our editorial writer. I write a syndicated column for Creators that's distributed to newspapers throughout the U.S., and we have several in eastern North Carolina that have picked it up. But primarily, you know, I'm involved with local news gathering, editing our local news, and our strategy for distributing that out online and through social media.
So news reporting and opinion writing, that signals to me that that's a small newsroom, news operation. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, absolutely. The Wilson Times is a proud community newspaper. The way it works at a lot of smaller papers is that the editor, the publisher, is also the editorial page editor. I think having a separate opinion department is a great luxury to have, but that's kind of reserved for just the largest of the metro papers. And most small and mid-sized papers don't have that kind of specialization.
In a sentence or three, what is community journalism?
I would say community journalism is primarily just local news coverage with an eye toward who our readers and who our stakeholders are. You know, we are not a big metro paper. You know, we don't serve hundreds of thousands of people. We're very at ground level. You know, the people who read our stories call us. We interact and communicate with them daily. And we just really try to keep that as our focus and our mission to serve our local constituents here in Wilson County and in our markets at each of our newspapers.
I think in some ways, the efforts to build trust are probably the same, whether you're in Lower Manhattan or Northeast North Carolina. But from your perspective, what are some of the most key components of fostering just a trust with the community and having a community newspaper, community journalism in place that really thrives?
Well, I think our greatest asset is that we are authentically a stakeholder here in the community. You know, we are not, you've probably heard the term parachute journalism or parachute reporting, where people from, say, a large news outlet will come into a small community and cover it when a tragedy or an emergency or a major news event occurs. But, you know, Wilson County is our backyard. We live, work, and play here, and the things we write about, like local property taxes and decisions of the city council and county commission and school board, they affect us just as they affect our readers because we live here. So, I mean, we're part of the community that we cover.
The Wilson Times has a print circulation of about 10,000. Online, Friedman says the paper has about 100,000 unique visitors each month. He leads a team of five reporters, three in news, two in sports. The paper still relies on advertising as its largest source of revenue. It does also have a paywall. And while Friedman acknowledges some challenges, he pushes back some on the notion that he's working in a news desert.
You know, as that term is defined specifically as having one outlet, I think we would technically meet that definition. But I don't consider Wilson or Wilson County a news desert, because I think we have pretty vibrant, robust coverage through the Wilson Times and through wilsontimes.com. You know, we're reporting local stories every day, continuously throughout the day, and we feel like our subscribers are not necessarily feeling like that they're in a news desert and they're deprived of that coverage. We feel like we provide that.
I'm going to play dreamer for a second. If you had a newsroom that was three or four times the size that it is, if you just had a greater arsenal of reporters, what stories or beats or things would you be able to cover that you are limited in doing now?
You know, I think the biggest thing is probably municipal government coverage in some of our smaller communities. Wilson County has seven municipalities. We have, you know, small towns like Sims, Lucama, Stantonsburg. Their town boards, they meet, you know, on the first Monday and Tuesday nights of the month. And of course, that conflicts with our city and county elected boards. And so we're not well resourced enough to provide coverage of every meeting of every local government in the county. And that's one thing that I would really like to see improved and find a way to provide that coverage to our readers in those communities. I wouldn't say that Wilson County is a news desert, but I would concede that we have certainly small towns and communities within Wilson County that don't receive the level of coverage that maybe your average constituent would need to be informed about all the issues that they face.
You're active on social media. I've noticed this. Tell me about how you try to utilize social media to bolster your journalism efforts from a rural reach of North Carolina.
We really believe in social media as a means of not only sharing our work, but with interacting with our readers. You know, we believe it's important to meet people where they are. We think it's important to make sure that we're on those platforms and that we're communicating and interacting with our readers. We're sharing our work. We're reaching out for feedback. You know, we found sources for stories on Twitter and Facebook. You know, Twitter is a great way to just get a broad cross-section of takes from kind of throughout the community. We noticed that our high school coaches and athletes are very active on Twitter. And so we just think that it's a great way to interact with folks and to make sure that anywhere that our readers, our constituency is, we want to be there too.
As journalists in more rural areas work to ensure a steady stream of relevant and reliable news, they're navigating a media world that's largely dictated by clicks, likes, and shares. Whether it's on Facebook, Twitter, or TikTok, information can spread in a flash on social media with mixed results.
I would be really wary of anyone who says it's all good or all bad. For news, for democracy, it's just not that simple.
Shannon McGregor is an assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Journalism School. She's also a senior researcher with the university's Center for Information, Technology, and Public Life. McGregor studies how social media influences politics, the press, and the public, and she says these platforms and how we use them are continuing to blur the lines of what is reputable, accurate political news and information.
One of the ways that it's blurred it is that journalists are very much on Twitter. You know, Twitter is not a social network that most Americans are on, but it is a place where most journalists, most people in politics are on. So it has this sort of special, and I would say outsized influence, you know, sort of in the news media and political world. But journalists are people, right? And so on Twitter, they don't just tweet their news headlines. They're humans, as they should be. But that means that readers or viewers know more about them than they might otherwise, right? About their personal lives, about their personal opinions. And so that has blurred the lines to some extent. Most people get a fair amount of news across, you know, their Facebook or maybe Instagram. But what do they consider news and do they remember where it came from, right? People will say, I saw this on Facebook, not I read it in the New York Times on Facebook, right? And that's sort of by design on Facebook and other social media platforms, you know, the way that they've designed their apps is that people have what some people have found in an experiment, what's called a source blindness. So they'll remember the platform that they saw the story on, and they might remember even some of the details about the story, but they don't remember the source of it, where it came from. And so that blurs the lines too, right? Because Facebook doesn't do news, right? Like, they're not in the business of actually doing it. So those are just two ways that I think it has sort of blurred the lines between some of these things.
This murkiness exists for any of us with a handle or profile. However, it's especially problematic for people with less access to reliable local news. And if social media is your source for what's happening in the community, McGregor suggests taking a closer second look.
You know, we increasingly see these so many of these communities, right, that don't have local reporting at all. And yet there are stakeholders in communities that need to get out information. There are stakeholders in communities that would like to spread misinformation, right? And they're still going to find ways to do that. So we've seen these sorts of things happen on Facebook groups, you know, in local communities. We've seen Nextdoor be used increasingly for, as like an outlet sort of for local news and local information. Facebook has been trying to get specifically into this sort of business, you know, courting small town governments to give them access to particular tools on Facebook so that they can share information with their constituencies. But none of those things are the same as news, you know? And so on the one hand, it potentially offers a way for people in a community who have not normally been able to be in power, have their voice heard, to do so, right? On the other hand, those same tools can be used by people to silence others, threaten others, spread information, you know, act anti-democratically. And so in these places where there is not news, there is not a lack of want for information. There's not a lack of a need for accountability. And so communities have turned to social media instead, I would say, with very mixed outcomes.
Those mixed outcomes are in part caused by a myriad of platforms, each offering a different way to receive and disseminate quote-unquote news. You have your big long-standing players like Facebook and Twitter, and then newer ones cropping up.
One of the emerging platforms right now is Clubhouse, which is a like voice primary social media. Right now, it's like sort of invite only, and so it's very elite sort of driven. Also, Twitch, you know, a streaming platform that people play video games on, but are using it for lots of other things as well. Also sort of doesn't have a political leaning, but the insurrection was used by some folks there to stream when they stormed the Capitol. And then we see some of the others that came more into the public consciousness after January 6th, like Parler. Sort of Gab has been around, but resurfaced, you know, in terms of people talking about it then. And DLive, which is another streaming platform.
We had CPAC recently. We had this gathering of conservative players and entities. Who emerged or what emerged? What did we learn, if anything, from a social media perspective coming out of that conference?
I mean, we saw lots of people posting images and videos from it. And certainly from that, we learned that there is still a lot of fealty within the Republican Party to Trump, right? I think this like viral image that came out of it of like gold statue of him and flip-flops, you know, that people were sort of adulating at. But I think we also learned that that conservatives are going to continue, because I think they found it quite effective, this idea of like playing the refs, of saying that social media platforms are silencing them, right? Are silencing conservative views.
Let's chat about elected officials, politicians, how they are using social media in 2021. It is certainly a way to cultivate a brand. It's a personal tool. How are elected officials using social media to get out their message and to build their brand?
The ones who are doing it well are able to garner, you know, not just state audiences, but national audiences and national news media attention through their effective use of social media. Social media is about sharing personal parts of ourselves, you know? And so when politicians do that, it's a bit tricky because they're also these very public figures, but they can't use social media coldly, right? And not personalize, because it would seem inauthentic. People wouldn't engage with that type of content.
First of all, I am sorry if this live is like very wide reaching. It's not my intent to ramble.
So we're seeing things like AOC doing her, you know, Instagram lives on things like what's going on in the House in January 6th.
And a lot led up to what went on. And I think it's important to talk about it.
But also on like her skincare routine, right? And so it's that these dimensions of the person as a politician, there's so many more of them that they're sort of being called to share on these platforms. And by called, I mean because of the norms of these platforms, right? Because it would be weird to not share anything personal on Instagram or on Facebook. But that can be limiting, right? Because not everyone, not every politician, A, has the comfort, right, in terms of doing that, but also has the stereotypical set of attributes or backgrounds or family life that we as Americans sort of generally expect. And so, you know, that can be limiting then for those people as well. You know, if you're sort of expected to have a family, but you don't have a family, then like, what else do you share to create that idea of like warmth on social media?
Right.
And so it can be limiting too.
Is it effectively a prerequisite at this point for somebody who is getting into the political game? Like, I think about a Mitch McConnell. He doesn't have to necessarily transform. Chuck Grassley from Iowa. Like, these elder statesmen of Congress, I mean, they've been there long enough. They have the power of incumbency. But for somebody who is now arriving on the scene, is it effectively a prerequisite to have a robust and kind of multifaceted social media approach in order to thrive in politics? Or am I overstating?
No, I don't think you are. And you have to for a couple reasons. One is because it's a very powerful tool to introduce yourself, especially as a newcomer to a political scene. It's a very effective way to control what that introduction looks like. You're not relying on the news to do it, right? You're introducing yourself, especially since 2016, we've seen a font of these like really viral like bio ad videos, you know, of like people introducing themselves.
I'm Kim Klasick. This is Baltimore. The real Baltimore.
This is a story about doors. A lot of them. And that's me, MJ Hagar, an Air Force combat veteran and a mom. This door behind me is from my Pavehawk helicopter. It's all that's left of the aircraft that I was flying that day.
And they garner national attention and national dollars. And that can be really important to a newcomer as well at a relatively low cost, right, of producing the video and sharing it on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. It also allows you to get more information, right? For every post that politicians put across different social media platforms, every ad they place, they're also getting information about who's engaging with it, you know, whether it's just on those platforms or whether people are clicking through, you know, and volunteering or signing up for emails. And so it's also a really effective tool to get data on your constituency, which is also very important when you're a newcomer.
So the social media entity, it has in some ways, and I'm thinking about former President Donald Trump as perhaps the most obvious example, allowed for the messaging, the persona building, the brand building. It allows these people to effectively cut out the middle person, the middle mouthpiece, which is the news media.
That's certainly what they're attempting to do, you know, while at the same time trying to use that social media then to get news coverage, right? Because like when there's one of these viral bio ads, or especially in the case of the former president, you know, I have some research that I'm doing that's ongoing that we find in his first year in office, 65% of his tweets ended up in a news story. Verbatim in a news story, mostly embedded with his image that people could click on. That's a very powerful tool to not only get to your own audience on Twitter, but then to expand your audience out to readers and viewers across dozens of news organizations as well. And this is not just the former president. I spoke to people who worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, you know, and they were not alone in this, but this is one example. You know, they'd say if they wanted to try and change sort of the news narrative around Senator Sanders, they'd tweet something, right? And then he'd be on TV 30 minutes later talking about it, right? And so they see that this is not only a powerful tool to reach out directly to the audience, but to influence the press as well. I'm not trying to point fingers at journalists about this. Journalists are increasingly trying to do more and more and more work with less and less resources, money, time, right? And if the president is not going to be holding regular press conferences, you have to use what he's tweeting, right? I mean, there's a very strong pressure to still have that information.
Maybe not verbatim.
Maybe not verbatim, I agree, but it creates a hard incentive structure to break.
Can you give me another data point, a contextual point? I mean, 8% of Mitt Romney's or 13% of this politics, like, give me somebody else if we know anybody else's. That seems like a huge number.
Remember before Trump, we all called Barack Obama our first social media president. In Barack Obama's first year of his second term, so 2013, 3% of his tweets were in news stories.
That's remarkable. Would you dare to render an estimate as to what percent, if we're sticking with every 4 years, Obama in 2013, Trump in 17, and Joe Biden here in 2021, what percentage of Joe Biden's tweets from this year will end up in news stories?
I think it'll be far less than 65%.
How much regulation do you think is needed and is realistic to come about in the next couple of years?
I think that we are likely to see some regulation coming in the next 2 years while the Democrats have sort of control across, you know, the board here in Washington. I don't think it will be sweeping. There are no easy answers to this. I think there is, at a minimum, regulation needed in terms of the size of some of these companies. And what we've learned over the course of especially the last 5 years, but what we knew before then, was ultimately the key moderation decisions come down to one person, to Mark Zuckerberg. And whether you agree with him or disagree with him, that's not great, right? That so much information is really ultimately at the highest levels decided by one person. And so, you know, I think there is very likely to be, and I think it will be meaningful, you know, regulation around breaking up some of these companies in terms of their power within our media ecosystem and our information ecosystem.
If you would like to hear more about how the pandemic has shaped social media, download and listen to the latest episode of Tested from WUNC. This episode of the Politics Podcast was produced by public radio utility man Charlie Shelton Ormond. My name is Jeff Tiberi, asking you to leave us a review wherever it is that you procured this podcast. Glowing, critique-filled, whatever your honest, engaged assessment is, please let us have it. We'll visit your feed again on Friday with a review of some of the week in state politics. Until then, thanks for listening.